This is SFNet Presents In the Know with host Barry Bobro, sponsored by Hilco Global.
Well, welcome everybody to the next episode of the In the Know podcast. Really excited today. We have a very special guest. Kathy Dick of Salt of the Earth Consulting is joining me today. Kathy is a very unique actor in the banking world. She spent 26 years with the OCC, rising to a very senior level, including being very involved in 2008 in the guidance that was given to banks coming out of the Dodd-Frank Act. She then moved over to the consulting side of the table and was working with Promontory for a number of years, a very well-known consulting firm that was owned by IBM on regulatory risk. Spent a couple of years as head of risk for USAA, and now has set up her own company, SOTE, which is Salt of the Earth Consulting. What a great name. That's why I got her on here, that she's now doing consulting with banks. And so without further ado, Kathy, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you.
Thank you, Barry. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Kathy, your bio is all over the Salt of the Earth website, so I don't want to drag you through your past, but I think you have a very unique perspective because you've been on effectively both sides of the discussion around regulatory, both from a financial institution standpoint and from the regulator. What would you say are the common misperceptions that each side has about the other?
Well, that's a good question, Barry, because when I first started my consulting work, I was talking to a former colleague from the OCC, and the question I got asked was essentially, what do these bankers pay you to do? And I said, essentially to explain what you want them to do. So a common misperception, I think, is that examiners believe bankers can understand, you know, the three or four sentences in an MRA and understand what it is they need to do to execute on some issue that an examiner has identified. So frequently, and that's really what I did for the 8 years I was at Promontory, was help bankers understand what it is the examiner is really looking for, because it's often, you know, knitted together in a mosaic from various reports they've been given or comments examiners have made. And another, I think, misperception by examiners is that bankers are driven solely by making money and not maybe appreciating that most bankers, again, actually are very committed to the business and industry of providing various financial products and services to consumers and businesses. So that those are two misperceptions I see, at least, you know, generally coming from examiners. Now with bankers and having, you know, sat on the other side of the table for the last few years of my career, I mean, one of the issues is the assumption that examiners have unlimited resources. They don't have oftentimes very many examiners to do the work, and they also don't have the, you know, same oftentimes, you know, depth of experience that a banker would have in any, you know, particular field. So in that case, much of my guidance was that you've got to be able to help those examiners understand better mm-hmm. some of the businesses that they're tasked with, you know, reviewing. And then oftentimes, I think, again, bankers believe examiners don't understand or don't want to understand some of the pressures involved, you know, in, again, banking businesses. And I think that oftentimes examiners do understand that, but they're really tasked with protecting either individual institutions or the system, not necessarily, you know, again, with seeing banks being as profitable as they can be. So those are a couple of the misperceptions, I guess, I've seen.
Well, certainly, you know, out of 08, I really don't want to go all the way back to 08 more than I have to, but the banks lost an awful lot of money. So just seeking profit, I mean, I think even without the regulatory overlay, banks would have made corrections to their structure and their risk management, because they can't keep doing that for their shareholders. It's not a formula for success.
That's right.
If those are the playing field of, you know, what the perceptions are, what would you say are the best practices for banks to avoid getting themselves into a poor position with their regulator?
Well, I would say the best practice is, you know, recognizing that a lot of the supervision process is founded on trust. So as a former examiner and, you know, again, a banker as part of my career as well, what I know is that if that trust is lost between a supervisor and the financial institution, could be management, could be the board, that you're going to have a problem. And how that trust erodes or disappears is usually caused by, you know, a couple common things. One is, you know, some bankers will attempt to hide things. And again, counsel I give to bankers that I've been working with is you have to, you know, be transparent with your regulars. When you have issues, you got to let them know. And they also want to know, you know, when good things are happening at the institution. But if an examiner finds that they're finding things that the banker hasn't told them about, that erodes that trust very quickly. Not taking care of issues in a timely manner. And, you know, again, this works two ways in terms of some banks are setting timeframes that they really can't meet, and therefore they sort of fail their own test. I've seen also examiners that ask for timeframes to fix issues that can't be met in terms of sort of being set up to fail. So that can be a problem. But if bankers aren't fixing the issues that they've identified or examiners have identified, that generally will impact the trust between, you know, the two parties. And then another one that's rather common is saying something's fixed and then an examiner comes in and tests it and finds problems. Mm-hmm. Because remember, they're just sampling. And so if they sample and find issues, they again, we'll lose trust very quickly in the management team that they're working with. So those are some of the, you know, common themes I see. Another one you don't see very often but does exist is pushback. You know, when a regulator examiner identifies an issue and a bank pushes back on it, you can push back, but it's got to be appropriate. And you have to recognize that in some cases, again, what an examiner is trained to do and look at and be concerned about from a risk perspective might be somewhat different than, you know, how you're sizing up those institutions mm-hmm. or issues yourself in the institution.
Kathy, would, and I've been on the, you know, examined a few times, but when the examiners come in, you know, every bank operates in a hierarchy with respect to their regulatory. And so the, you know, one of the concerns that I think bankers at the, you know, actually responding may have is this an issue for me to be talking to the regulator about, or is there somebody more senior than me who really should bring this up, whether it's the scope or the back and forth? There's sort of a political context to it. Is it the same on the regulator's side?
It sure is. And that's a great point. I mean, one of the things that I counseled institutions I work with on is make sure that you do, you know, escalate an issue before you bring it to a regulator to identify who should be providing that information to a regulator. Another thing is every issue doesn't have to be brought to an examiner, right? So understanding what your examiner cares about, what they're worried about, helps you as a banker identify what it is you should escalate to them. But within the agencies also, and they vary between the OCC, FDIC, and Federal Reserve, the examiner at the front line will have certain authority or responsibility, and then other issues, you know, can have to be escalated internally within the agency. So I think it works, you know, the same on both sides.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming into a period of time here. There's a, you know, I'm not making this up. There's actually economists predicting a recession, and we're debating how deep it will be. I'm sure the regulator sees the same thing. What would you be advising your bank? What are you advising your bank clients to do right now to help them best position for an economic deterioration? Should they be moving to downgrade? Should they be doing it, ahead of or waiting for guidance from the regulator?
Yeah. So again, what a regulator is going to focus on when they're concerned about, you know, state of the economy primarily is going to be credit quality. And if you're a bank that doesn't have a, you know, rigorous system for classifying your loans, developing your loan and lease losses portfolio, et cetera, that's something that would certainly be working on and watching for examiners to look at more deeply. With things like classifying loans, it's not required that a bank align with the regulatory framework of loss, doubtful, substandard, and special mention. But remember, that's the way they're going to look at your mm-hmm. portfolio. So the more you can map cleanly, you know, between however you want to risk rate.
It's a really interesting point. It helps. Every bank has their own system. And as a syndicator of loans, it really wasn't until, I would say, 9 or 10 I would have discussions internally about the syndication of a loan and say, banks might perceive it as not as as a non-pass credit, and people would stare at me before that and just with like, what are you talking about? We rated it this. Here's our numerical system. We rated it, but it does ultimately map into a regulatory framework that is special mention, substandard, doubtful loss, which are non-pass or pass.
Right. And again, I think to your point, prior to that, examiners really didn't, you know, push banks to have systems that map neatly to theirs. But when it has an effect, if you will, on the bottom line, on, you know, market liquidity in terms of, like you said, loans you can hold, loans you can sell, then I think banks started to coalesce around risk rating systems that start to look much more alike now across at least the large institutions.
Okay, so let's get to the very topical, the stress test just came out. So Kathy, can you give us, I'm afraid, don't talk over my head here, but you know, what is CCAR, what are stress tests, you know, who conducts them, why were they put together in the first place as a result of the 08 legislation?
Sure. Nine. So CCAR is the Comprehensive Capital Analysis and Review that's done by the Federal Reserve. And that started, I think it was in 2010. But the anchoring of the stress test really came about in 2008 with the financial crisis and, you know, the first of banks that experienced runs and large banks, right, that the regulators had to address. And so if we think about that scenario, the environment we're in back then, globally, we had large banks that were experiencing significant liquidity issues. And as regulators, we were trying to figure out, you know, what can we do in the United States to help stem that tide? And a lot of countries were doing stress testing. But in the US, we had a number of conversations about what do we do when we get those results? And through very healthy conversation across all agencies, including, you know, Treasury and other key stakeholders, we made the decision that we were going to make the results public. Because through conversations with folks in the industry, and especially investors, they said, if you don't make the results public, it's not going to change anything. So made the decision, we're going to make the results public. And that really became then the stress tests that you see today, that foundation. They've changed over time. The capital rules have changed over time with the capital buffer that came out the last few years, but or stress test buffer. But the goal and the purpose of the stress test really is to allow the regulators to conduct a horizontal, if you will, capital assessment across institutions. And the very largest banks get this every year, and the Federal Reserve does it at the holding company level. And then the OCC will do at the bank level for banks, again, over $50 billion, and generally every other year for those banks. So it really is a tool used by the regulators to, I think, provide some confidence really to other parties and interested stakeholders about the status of large financial institutions in the U.S.
Based on your, you know, you were inside the regulatory environment, and now you're still in touch, I'm sure, with a lot of your colleagues there. Are they happy with the way these are working? Are there problems for them with the current configuration, or does it feel stable to you?
It's reasonably stable. So the couple of things I think to keep in mind about the stress test. One, there's a level of transparency, right? They put out the scenarios, they put out results. But in the end, the determination of capital adequacy done by a regulator is also something that's done behind closed doors. So when we see things like these stress test buffers, you know, increasing now, part of the reason for that is because the stress tests are countercyclical. So 2021 was a good, strong year in the banking system. Regulators are going to look for more capital now, because one of the issues with the crisis was you can't raise a lot of capital when you're in the middle of some sort of stress scenario. So I think that's something to take into consideration. And I think overall the regulators are pretty satisfied with the process they have. And I think most bankers are too.
Yeah, I think so too. The one thing that's notable is that some of the criteria change yearly. The format stays about the same, but the criteria change. And you note that it's somewhat countercyclical. What can you? I look through the 100 pages or so of the most recent stress tests, and I understood everything but the tables, I guess. But the but based on what you see in the results, how did they look? Because there were some large banks that that looked like they might need to raise a little bit of capital in the out quarters, but nobody failed the test. How do you interpret the most recent results?
Well, I think another thing that's important about that, and this is, you know, again, my view, but I don't think regulators look at the exact output every year and make any significant determinations. It's really the trends over time and how things change from year to year. So when we see financial institutions that maybe need to raise capital, it's probably because they have been running their capital lower than what a regulator would like. So remember, we have capital rules, but they're minimums, and everybody far exceeded that. But wherever they've got institutions with maybe a concentration in the loan portfolio, they're going to look for more of a, you know, stress test buffer, because that's where, you know, problems will emerge. Or if a bank is, you know, again, generating loans in either industries that are of concern to a regulator, and you and I've had, you know, great conversations over the years about some of the industries, you know, they care about, that's where they're going to be looking for more of a stress test buffer than maybe what the bank had initially intended.
Mm-hmm.
Or expected.
I looked at some of the public disclosure, the quarterly earnings of some of the large financial institutions, and without picking on anybody, because that would get both of us in trouble, it looked to me like the magnitude of capital that banks think they need to raise isn't not an insurmountable, it's a short-term issue. Some banks are curtailing or cutting back significantly on their share repurchases. That's one way of doing it. Others, you know, we hear in the market are implementing some moves that would either raise the cost of capital internally, raise the bar for their capital tests, or are putting more restrictions on capital for non-core clients. But it's not actually it looks all very doable. Do you see it differently?
No, I think you've got it spot on correct. And I think, you know, a couple of observations, again, having been in the banking industry in one way or another for longer than I would care to disclose. I mean, it is a very cyclical business, right? And what examiners know is that there will be a downturn. And, you know, and I've seen in my career, agriculture being one of the reasons for a downturn, commercial real estate, and certainly with the 2008 crisis. I mean, I remember conversations, you know, within the OCC at the time of the fact that we could see, if you will, deterioration or more generous lending terms in residential real estate. But no one believed we'd ever see like the whole housing market decline.
Right.
So
systemic problems. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that's what you see with the regulator is.
Well, one of the things that's near and dear to the heart of I think the audience for the podcast and asset-based lending generally is the leveraged lending question. It's there. We haven't talked about it a lot lately, but it always struck me how differently different banks approach. Is it a leveraged loan? Is it not? Does it meet the ABL carve out or does it not? There's black and white letters in all of the guidance, and yet banks interpret very differently. And I, without getting too specific, what's the context for why you think banks interpret it differently? Do they just have a different dialogue with the regulator?
I think that's often going to be the case. I mean, the couple of things to remember about the leveraged lending is, one, it is guidance. So again, an examiner, depending on which agency you're talking about, may have more latitude at the front line to, you know, interpret that differently, one examiner to another. Generally, I would say where they are more generous, if you will, in their view on the leverage lending, it would be because the bank has a history of doing that lending well. They've got a stable management team. They appropriately risk rate their loans. So an examiner is more comfortable that their view of risk in that portfolio is akin to what the banker is expressing as risk. But we've talked about leverage lending too. It's a bellwether from, you know, I think the regulator's perspective in terms of often, you know, the type of lending that can emerge as problematic for a bank in a downturn and one of the first portfolios. So Barry, how do you think banks in the market are reacting to the current environment? And what do you hear about the stress tests and some of the news that's coming forth from bankers?
Yeah, you know, there's always a, every bank has a, there's a dynamic, you know, as you described, between the banks and the regulators. You have to have profits in order to be a good public company. So there's the push for doing more, being more aggressive, pushing the envelope. And then there's also the risk team that has a different set of incentives. And there's a yin and yang to that. I think the current environment is going in favor of the credit people. It almost has to. I mean, you know, the tools that they have at their disposal, it's going to differ from bank to bank. But you know, there's, in advance of our next exam, let's make sure that we've conservatively rated things, which let's get inside of the credit committee and not take things on that look like you're doing it at the wrong time in the cycle. So it has sort of a natural, and it's having a natural dampening on bank lending right now. It takes a while for that to take effect because you've got a pipeline of loans at any point in time, and it's not like the memo comes out and everybody just immediately changes behavior, but it's definitely causing banks to be more cautious, as I think it should. But that in and of itself restricts liquidity from the bank market. In terms of the particulars on the stress test, there, I know that banks want to be more rigorous about their models. We saw it in the dramatically in the early stages of the pandemic. Every bank that didn't have a two-tiered approval system seemed to put one in. So you're approving credit, and then you're also approving capital. And you're trying to, when you downgrade loans, the consequence internally is that it attracts more regulatory capital. And the question for any bank is, are you going to use regulatory capital as the equivalent of a loss? In other words, are you going to say, we're losing money because we just downgraded these loans? Or are you going to say, we're downgrading them because we have to, because it looks appropriate, but we're going to continue to make good credit? And as you point out, if you've got good risk mitigation, you know, you should be able to do that. I think the banks are definitely being more cautious. And I think that the stress test is resulting in some banks looking for ways to restrict capital, particularly to the asset-based market. You know, having said that, anybody who's predicting that will increase pricing is underestimating how competitive the market is and how many players there are in it. So I don't think there's any clear view on that. It is a very competitive market.
And in that particular market, right, you have a lot of non-bank players. And so that's, you know, part of the issue, right? It's not exclusively banks.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Although, you know, banks have such a huge cost of funds advantage over any non-bank. You know, the non-banks borrow from banks as their cost of funds. And so, you know, if you cross that imaginary line or that gray line where banks won't finance you, but a non-bank asset-based lender will, it's almost discontinuous. The banks will lend up to a certain price and then they won't take the risk anymore. So it's not a smooth risk return curve. It should be, but it never has been. And the non-banks have a floor. They won't go below it. And actually, in the current environment with other markets gapping out, there's a relative value calculation that they do. So yeah, there's a very healthy, robust non-bank asset-based market. It's more expensive and probably more structured. And so companies will try to hold on to their bank deals as long as they can until they're convinced that they can't. But a question for you, Kathy, how the non-banks, they have regulators, but it's none of the people you listed off. At least I don't think so. How does the regulator, I mean, they have the SEC, if they're a BDC, they have that. But how do the regulators approach the rapid growth in the non-bank, and I'm just talking about asset-based lending, the non-bank lending world? And do you think that there needs to be some regulatory change as a result of the growth?
Well, one of the changes in Dodd-Frank was, prior to Dodd-Frank, we had the President's Working Group, which was actually a very small group of agencies, but informally. For instance, the OCC was not part of the President's Working Group technically, but we were invited to those meetings. With Dodd-Frank, the Financial Stability Oversight Council was formed, which sort of legitimized a large group of financial regulatory agencies that now meet on a regular basis. They've got the OFR for financial research. So I think there is a lot more dialogue that takes place between regulators of banks as well as other financial institutions that are not banks. And I think that's healthy, you know, for the system, again, for people to understand, because certainly in 2008, there was, I think, you know, a view anyway, that there were blind spots, that people didn't really understand who was actually buying some of the, you know, mortgage paper. And I think there was, you know, again, a bubble created that many felt like we really didn't have a clean view on. So I think the dialogue's much richer today, and which allows regulators then to act, you know, in a more reasonable kind of manner, act earlier if they feel like, again, something needs to be, you know, tamped down, as opposed to, you know, being surprised.
But the size of the non-bank lending world has just grown so dramatically, and it's really shining. I've highlighted in a couple of the other podcasts that we've done, but because of the lack of activity or the dysfunction of the public high yield and the institutional loan market right now, the non-bank market is having a very good time. Larger and larger facilities, more capacity. Do you think that causes some urgency on the regulator to actually have a more formal regulatory overlook?
I suspect it will. Well, whether any actual action takes place, I'm not sure. But I know when I was the supervisor anyway, that was always one of my biggest concerns, was the, you know, non-bank lending and what those players are doing. And it's certainly part of things like the shared national credit process.
Right.
So, yeah, there's certainly a lens on that. But I suspect, yeah, the conversations are, you know, deeper and more frequent now within the agencies.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, that's all the time we have. I should have said at the outset, but the title here, The Inside Scoop on Regulation for a former OCC senior leader. I think we hit all the hot buttons there. And I wish you luck with your consulting business with your daughters.
Thank you.
And sounds like you're off to a running start. And to the extent that anybody listening wants to learn more about how they might work with you, Salt of the Earth Consulting, go to the website, give Kathy a call. She's been a real supporter. She's spoken at ABCC a couple times, and hopefully we'll get her back soon. Kathy, thanks for joining today.
Thank you, Barry. It was a pleasure.
Well, that was an excellent discussion with Kathy Dick. Kathy's the founder of Salt of the Earth Consulting, her company, but also has a very long career with the OCC and in consulting for Promontory, as well as working at USAA. Kathy's got a very unique perspective, having been on both sides of the regulatory table. And our goal was to pull back the curtain a bit on the regulatory environment, CCAR stress tests, leveraged lending guidance, and to go through best practices for banks as they establish their regulatory frameworks and their exams. And I think we covered that really well, so I won't recap too much of the discussion here. But we talked about the heightened caution in the current economic environment, the relatively good results of the most recent stress tests, but some of the conclusions that came out of it, and also touched on the regulation of non-banks, something I hope everybody pays attention to as well, because of the growth of the non-bank lending world. I want to thank SFNet for their continuing support of the In the Know podcast, and special thanks to Hilco Global for their sponsorship of the entire In the Know series.